welcome to Dr. Who Podcast, everybody. Thank you for being here. We appreciate you supporting it. Tell a friend. Support those that support us. Click through on the Amazon banner. It does not cost you a thing, but keeps wins in the sale of the Corolla Pirate Ship. Hey, go to doctor.com. Check up on the contact list. I appreciate you being there for that. Check out the Opium series about how we got into the opiate crisis there and the family of podcasts there. I can't think. Is there anything else? Oh, look for my Instagram page at Dr. Drew Pinsky. I'm going to start doing some Instagram videos. I am excited to bring in Amira and Greg Barrett. They have a podcast, Maybe It's You. They have a new book, How to Keep Your Marriage from Sucking, The Keys to Keep Your Wedlock Out of Deadlock. Podcast is on iTunes.
Yes.
And the book is from usual places, Amazon.
Wherever you can buy books these days.
You can follow Greg at Gregory Barrett, B-E-H-R-E-N-D-T.
Yep.
Mara at Ms. America.
Ms. America.
Like Ms. America.
America. M-S-A-M-I-I-R-I-C-A is the Twitter handle. And so what's in the book?
You know, we wrote this book, How to Keep Your Marriage from Sucking, when our marriage was super sucking. And we did sort of like a forensic CSI trying to figure out like why things had gotten to that point. Because a lot of our friends' marriages were falling apart. And we realized that, you know, we could kind of trace back all of the – you know,
the suckiness,
like those engagement for the first 5 years where we had beautifully planted some gorgeous landmines that would explode later on in our marriage. Mm. And so we, you know, decided.
So things you didn't deal with. Shocking.
Yeah. Also things that you don't think are going to, you know, conversations that you don't want to have or in the early stages or things. Well, like somebody will say, I go like, I would love to tell you what it was like when I was an alcoholic. And she's like, I don't love those stories. And then you're like, okay. And then all of a sudden I have an opiate problem later on in life, or opiate problem later on. And suddenly it's all new news. You know, trying to explain yourself.
When so you're she didn't want to hear your stories that were personal and important to you.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
And so she shut off a piece of you sort of in a weird way.
That's right.
For
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, that's right. And what happens is if you, as you know, you get a full life and suddenly even having conversations are impossible. So for a lot of the time,
because there's no time, or because
there's no time.
Well, as time goes on, like at the beginning, relationships are super fun. Everything's buoyant. You're the best you. They're the best them. But you put 365 days a year and 5-10 years on that on that vehicle, and all of a sudden, there's these historic resentments and these accommodations that you've made,
and you haven't built in anything. You haven't built in a daily ritual or a practice. That you, hey, we got to sit down and really have a talk.
And I want to remind people, you guys got crazy busy. I think people know Greg wrote the book, He's Just Not That Into You, that became the movie, and then a daytime talk show. And in that period, you're crazy busy. And you were
crazy.
Producing the talk show,
weren't you? Yeah. And then we wrote more books. We wrote, it's called A Break Because It's Broken, and it's just an effing date, and we had kids. And
how many kids you guys have now?
We have two teenage girls.
16
it's
to 13.
The greatest. Okay. I couldn't be happier. They're
good.
Lovely.
Okay, good.
Yeah, weather patterns. You know, girls are, you know, I mean, like you can watch it. They're like Hawaiian skies. They change right in front of you. It's like it's really dark, and then it's bright.
And that's obvious to your wife. But to you, you just stand by going, what's happening?
Yes.
What is this?
Right. But then, as a recovering drug addict and alcoholic, I go, oh, no, I get you. I know exactly what that mood swing is. I'm just going to stand over here. And when you really need to talk, I'm over here because I get it. And you're the one that cries during the movies when I do. So we're both a little bit on the, you know. I actually realized I had more in common, and I like to sort of stand back a little bit and not have to. But one thing I learned from my marriage immediately, and I think just in life, if someone hasn't put a question mark at the end of the sentence, I don't need to be talking.
Yeah.
You know, I find myself sometimes.
Especially, that's for women, if you're male, for you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, as a male, they just want us to listen. Not to respond or to fix.
But Greg is a performer.
Because we recommend things
nature.
To each other all the time. Men recommend. Hey, man, you know what I was thinking? I saw what you were doing there.
Why are we talking if we're not like trying to help each other?
I don't know what we would be doing. Right. I mean, I'd love a back rub, but probably not from you, or I don't know.
No, dude, I just need you to listen to my feelings for a minute.
Yes. No, I don't need a monologue coming back at me. I just want you to hear it and then go, oh, that sucks, babe, and then walk away.
Yeah, with most of my friends, there's a task. Like, I don't have most of my friends are like, we're either in a band together or we're working on.
Yeah, you're doing stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're fake writing a show we're not doing, but we have a reason to get together. It's like, we should get together and talk about that idea we had. And then you know.
That's really funny.
But I do find that in our marriage, we had not learned how to talk. And quite honestly, the book was something that had sat around for a while, and we were having a very hard time getting done because we sold the idea
book?
Of it. Yes.
Well, okay. When our marriage was sucking, we actually sold the idea for the book.
Because and your marriage was sucking?
Because our marriage was sucking. We were trying, and we were separated at the time, and we were trying to
make it work
and figure it out.
Were you getting professional help?
We were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
We were in couples therapy, and we were trying to make it work. And then, so we were pushing the rock up the hill, trying diligently, and then Greg was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm.
And so it got put on the back burner for a couple of years, and then, you know, a bunch of our friends started splitting up and having...
Did you come into his aid at that point?
Yes. Of course.
Yes, but it was still...
Well, not of course. I mean, it's not everyone
well,
does that.
Well, I mean, yes, but, you know, there still was tension between us.
But that's
us.
A not sucky move.
There was still tension between us, and, you know, there's definitely days like... You know, where you go, oh, if I had bailed on this marriage that I had spent 15 years building, this wouldn't be my problem. But at the end of the day, in my heart of hearts, that's not what I felt. I was like, right. I want to help him. I want to, you know, I want him to be well. And this is part of the for worse.
Let's talk. Yes.
It's part of the for worse of marriage. And there's little for worse and big for worse.
Well, right?
And then I doubled down because I needed to get back on the road, you know, for various reasons. And I couldn't. And I had been on... OxyContin the whole time.
For the cancer.
For the surgery. And, he had stomach surgery.
And I couldn't get off. And I was on the road and I started to withdraw. And so I reached out to somebody there and then there I went. Right down the same path. And I read this, I saw this TED talk the other day about how much a guy was prescribed and how they tried to take him off. And it was the same thing with me. It was too fast, too quick. And it was too painful. And I needed to stay working. And then because I'd lied about where I got the pills, I went right into that behavior. It just was like an old shoe.
Yeah,
and I just put it on, and then I was lying about it. The next thing you know, I've got pills that don't have my name on them. Agnes! Well, I've got a few, you know. So, but I got through it, you know. You add all that stuff up to a marriage, you know, and you're still got your kids in school, and, you know, your careers are what they are.
Well,
and
this is a monumental battle you guys were waging.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is. I mean, multiple fronts, multiple issues, multiple stressors. It's phenomenal that you were able not just to get through it, but to share and write about it.
You know, it's funny because when we first wrote the book, it was a much bigger book, and then we decided to break it in two. So we have this one that came out today, How to Keep a Marriage from Sucking, and then in January we're releasing We Used to Be in Love and Now We Work Here, which is dealing with the much more heavy aspect of the four worses of marriage. Because we do we have had a lot of experience for the 18 years we've been married. Mm. We've dipped our toe in many a pool.
And our luck.
But again, if we had just set boundaries and not made these, you know, accommodations where it just sort of became habit versus actual.
Well, give me an example. You're saying accommodations. I think I know what you mean.
So, you know, early in our relationship, you know, whether it's with, you know, where you're going to dinner or what works to put the baby down, if something is okay once, we start assuming it's okay every time.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't care about that. Or that's not important to them. And, you know, you find yourself in these patterns where one person is being privileged more than the other and the other is quietly building a sweet, sweet resentment.
It's unexpressed feelings.
It's unexpressed feelings or the idea that you're okay with something and then as you evolve and your life changes, it stops feeling okay, but you don't feel able to say, you know, this doesn't work for me anymore because it's still working for the other person.
Mm.
So, you know, that's what we talk about in the book about like the landmines, how we continue putting these things out there that build up and then they sort of explode because you haven't had a difficult conversation that probably wouldn't even be that difficult.
Could you give an example of one of the landmines?
Do you want to take one of these?
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
No, you do it.
No. That's all right. Go ahead.
Just one. Easy.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
Give me an easy one.
I wasn't going to go easy. I was going to go for like sex.
Okay.
You know, like there was, you know, like Greg said, you know, how early on I didn't want to hear his stories, his like, you know, drunken promiscuous.
His war stories.
That kind of stuff. Because I was like, I really felt like, you know, I grew up in a, you know, a fairly conservative home. And I was just like, it's going to change the way I feel about you. I don't want to know this. And then, you know, it became, you know, me not knowing what's important to him as for his sexual identity, because I was like, nope, I'm not hearing that. You know?
And then he became afraid probably to give you the full picture
exactly.
of who he was.
100%.
And then it's that kind of stuff. And then every time, you know, you don't, you know, respond to someone's cues or compliment them on their thing, then all of a sudden it's this historic injury that actually goes back to this is who I am as a person, and you're rejecting who I am as a person when that's not the motivation or the intent that it, you know, and it could be for anything of like you always put your dishes in the sink. Why can't they make it into it? It doesn't matter what it is. There's things that you start feeling.
You ascribe motive.
You ascribe motive
to people. You give them monologues they're not having or you're having with them about why it's happening. And then there's also that, you know, in most cases, most people don't set out to hurt people.
Right.
They just don't know.
Especially not their favorite person.
Done things, or they've come from a whole different family of origin where things are done completely differently. You know, there's sometimes where I go, my family didn't live like that. That isn't who we were. I don't know why we're ascribing these rules to my life that's also mine. My parents left their doors open. They left their keys in their car. I'm very lax about that stuff. On the other hand, their bedroom doors and their bathroom doors were shut. And ours are open.
Huh. And my parents both worked for the CIA, and we were put through drills.
Oh,
and everything was locked down all the time, and doors were always open, and it was all about the kids. So we did not line up at all on those things.
Which is also what I like about her, because when it all goes down, we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
If it all goes down and I'm in charge.
I've already gone through the drills.
I've got some skin creams.
Right.
You know, like
I've got the portable defibrillator, the escape plan. I have the whole thing.
The smoke hoods and the ladder for the
iodine tablets. I've got the whole deal.
Do you have that? Do you find that in your – do you find that you and your wife occupy different places in your marriage?
Yes. Yes. But I always feel like some of this stuff – there's things that are very, very similar and sort of – thankfully, I would also sort of describe it as sort of biorhythmically sort of similar and enjoy the same things the same way. And that, but when it comes to certain attributes like mechanical stuff, she's very mechanical. I am not. I like that. I like when somebody has one set of skills. And
right.
Even if they're not something I'm accustomed to in terms of my living environment, I like personally. We have to ask her if she, you know.
Are you a worrier?
Very much.
Is she a worrier?
No.
Okay. Right. So that's a big one.
Yeah.
That's a big one because you need to be made safe.
And I couldn't stand to be around another warrior. It would drive me crazy.
Of course. That would be even worse. Part of what she likes about me is that I do have a little bit of a like, dude, it's going to be okay. Like,
well, yeah.
Come join us in the moment. It hasn't happened yet.
Do you have an Al-Anon program? Do you take some of that there?
You know, I have – Greg's like, no. I have gone to Al-Anon meetings. I don't go –
You don't have a program. You just go to meetings once in a while.
I go to meetings once in a while, but I should. I should because, you know. Because
that part, you know, I deal with this stuff a lot. And that start, you see that. It's
right.
there.
Right.
And it may not be, you know, it's necessary when it's necessary. That's all.
Right.
It's not something you have to do.
No, but genuinely the detached with love thing and realizing it's not, you know, it's not about me. What's going on with him is not about me.
I think because of the way marriage has evolved, you know, in the in my parents' generation, people lived with resentments, and they lived within the confines of their partner's resentment. Sometimes, usually, one person has transgressed, and the other person holds a heavy resentment in those situations, and then they stay in that world. And what happens is the negative always wins out in that world. So that's what happens to them, even as a couple, and even to their lives. And either that person just doesn't ever come home, and because that's the only way they know how to survive, or they're home and they're not thriving.
Right.
And
shut down or whatever.
Right. And both people are having a bad time and nobody, not your friends, not your kids, not the animals, nobody thinks it's okay. Mm. So they sort of wonder, well, why are you continuing? But in your head, you're like, well, we're trying to keep it all together. And if we split up, you know, and I think we sort of came to that this year that like, hey, we need to look at this stuff and dump it. Because if we don't, and also when we do, we thrive. And it's just like people get sober. You're like, why did they go out? I don't know, because they were so happy, but because they didn't do it on a daily.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. I think the thing in this book, it suggests that like, look, it's a practice. Stay married till midnight.
It's not an institution.
Do something every day that feels like 15 seconds, just the two of you locking eyes, just being quietly in a room together. It doesn't have to be deep. But if it's a thing that says, this is the marriage. The marriage is the universe that we've created that the kids live in, where the marriage is still at the top. I think also we live in a world now where your kids are the most important thing in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And that I don't know if that 100% makes sense, because somebody, usually the dad or the one that didn't give birth, is standing on the outside of that circle. Because now you're only talking about what's going on with the kids.
And so in the book, is it your story, or is there a how-to and sort of advice for the reader?
It's all of those things. Yeah. I mean, we share our experiences of how we blew it.
Is this in the podcast too? Maybe it's you?
It is. I mean, we talk, and maybe it's you. We talk, you know, sometimes just us with guests taking letters, and it's about, you know, identifying behaviors and your relationships and patterns and figuring out, like, what part of it is you. And sometimes – you know, sometimes you're the great part, but sometimes you're also not the great part.
Right.
And looking at how that stuff manifests, you know, like you start it in dating, and you start by the way you date, and you start by the way you and friendships, like all of those, you know, you're in charge of all of your relationships. And sometimes, you know, you look up and realize, man, people aren't talking to me, and I'm not really sure why. And, you know, we really want to ascribe some sort of, you know, people didn't like, you know, I'm not famous anymore, or something like that. And you're like, well, okay. Let's go back and figure out what that's really about. And maybe there's a reason why you're not famous anymore, too. And I bet it has a lot to do with your behavior and not a lot to do with your talent.
New to Podcast One, it is The Trials of the Vampire, straight out of Australia. When a male prostitute is accused of raping and mutilating a client, few doubt his guilt. The attack was shocking, and the victim claims the attacker boasted about being a 200-year-old vampire. To hear the whole story, you must go to podcastone.com or make sure you get the new Podcast One app. This is a story you do not want to miss. I want to discuss omega-3s for you in a second. Omax-3, ultra pure, the purest omega-3 supplement on the market. That's right. In case you're unaware, omega-3s have been found to be a very healthy supplement. There is some back and forth in the literature, but I'm sufficiently convinced that I take them myself, and I specifically take Omax-3 ultra pure. It's almost 94% pure omega-3 fatty acids. Purest concentration on the market, and they have a patented EPA to DHA ratio of 4:1 that is specifically engineered for inflammation and joint pain. But of course, you also know it's great for cardiovascular health, improving your triglyceride levels. There's a cool thing you can do called the freezer challenge. Basically, if you freeze any other omega-3 supplement, it gets cloudy. It's all filler, but the Omax-3 soft gel remains clear because it is that pure. It's clinically tested, and it's a purest option, so there's no fish burps or anything like that. So whether you're an athlete, a student, busy parents, or a working professional, anyone can benefit from Omax-3 Ultra Pure. Go to tryomax.com/Drew to get a box. It is Omax-3 Ultra Pure. I did it for free with your first purchase. Tryomax.com/Drew. It's O-M-A-X. Tryomax.com/Drew, and you'll get a free box of Omega-3 with your first purchase. It's a lot of product. Tryomax.com/Drew. Terms and condition apply. Omax-3 comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have plenty of time to try it and really feel the Omax difference. All right, you're looking to buy a car. You may have heard terms like MSRP. You might be familiar with them, but do you really know what they stand for? What it means? Same goes for invoice, list price, dealer price, all that stuff. It's just enough to confuse anybody. What you want is the true price, the actual price. And now you have true price from True Car. You'll know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership. And True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home. How do you know True Price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people paid for the car you want. You see that scattergram. You lock in that price, and your certified dealers know this, so they set the true price competitively so they can win your business. And once you lock in that price, you know you've locked in a price for an actual vehicle on a True Car certified dealer's lot. So when you're ready to buy new or used, visit True Car. That's right. Get that true price from True Car, whether you're buying new or used, and visit True Car and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Let's take a call. It's a pretty good call for you guys. This is Sam, 46 North Carolina. Sam, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Drew. I have been in a relationship with a woman for about 7 months, and she's currently in rehab. There was an intervention with her from her parents and other people in her life, and she willingly said, "Yep, you know what? I'm gonna do it." And she's committed herself. She's been in rehab for 1 week. This is her first time in.
What was the drug?
Alcohol and also Adderall, which was prescribed to her by her physician.
Don't even start me. I can't tell you how many people are taken down by Adderall as prescribed. It's a terrible drug for people that have addiction. Terrible. and bipolar
okay,
too.
Okay, well, that's,
so anyway.
All right. Well, that's one of my questions was that I didn't. My essential question is how can I be helpful? Like how can I be the most helpful, supportive person in her life that I can be?
Well, it's great.
What more data do
so
you need for
we'll,
me?
We'll,
first of all, that's the nicest question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
That is so lovely that's your question.
And you and I will talk
about it. It's not what about me.
Right. And we'll talk about it from the codependent perspective. Greg, what would somebody want 7 weeks into
well,
7 days into treatment?
I'd say you're there. That's really that is your raison d'être. What can I do? And that may just be, can you be quiet? And I'm gonna be rebuilding myself from the bottom up. And they're gonna say to me, you shouldn't be in a relationship. That is recommended or is said a lot.
They also say don't make any major changes.
That's also true.
This relationship might survive.
It's already underway.
Yeah, it's
that's
been
right.
7 months in.
Yes, I think they say don't get in. And if you're not in one, don't. And that's because people come in usually behind a relationship. So you get to be the world's nicest, quietest guy and just see what needs doing and be willing to sort of ride it out because it'll be tough for you because they're going to be learning how to. It's like having a big baby. You know, you get your feelings come back and all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's what people sound like. And oh, this is what sex is. And all it's all weird and loud and hard.
Here's a specific question. Should I never drink around her?
I would not. I would keep. I just have a just general philosophy that for the first year, keep certainly the home environment completely safe. What you do. You know, when you go out together, I think it's a nice gesture not even to think about using alcohol around her. I think after she's been sober for a while, it won't matter at all. But early on, you just got to keep things safe and not, you know, make her trigger in any way. Would you agree, Gregor?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, if that's something you can do, if you can do without it, then that's great. I mean, that isn't possible. My parents made my sister go live somewhere else because they weren't going to get rid of their booze in their home. So they made my sister go live with my grandmother.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's
your parents, not
for her, but yes.
What's their ethnicity?
They were WASPy. They were white.
Where are the ancestors from? Do we know?
Oh, Italian.
Italian.
And, yeah. Yeah. And Welsh.
I was going to say no Scottish, Irish.
Yeah.
Welsh.
No, my mom. Yeah. 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 My mom.
So definitely
who flew the flag about. She wrote it all the way.
Nice.
Good
for her. Now, for you, it turns out there's family treatment, right? Has she invited you to any of those programs? Sam?
You know, this happened 1 week ago, so she's in rehab for 1 week. She's currently not in the same city.
Well, but they usually have a family, either family week or family weekends, that kind of thing. So you might
I'm invited to come next Sunday from 1 to 4.
Go to that.
Okay.
And then start to go to something called Al-Anon, which if you look online, there'll be Al-Anons all around wherever you live. They're everywhere. And go there, raise your hand and say, I need help. And I've got somebody I love who's in treatment. And tell your story. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
but you are.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Sam.
So you are, Dr. Drew, skeptical about Adderall because I wasn't sure.
Skeptical?
On the one hand.
I'm not skeptical. Yeah. I'm outraged. I'm furious. I'm angry when my peers do that because I've many a patient have either – Philip Seymour Hoffman is dead of opiate addiction because somebody gave him Adderall. I guarantee you that's why he went out. On his bedside was needles and heroin and Adderall. And I thought, why he – this is a guy with 20 years of sobriety goes out. Why would he go out? Oh, a doctor gave him Adderall. That's it. That takes people down like crazy. She's not to take that medicine anymore. I mean, whatever.
Okay, that's what she's told by the clinic, and I just didn't because I feel bad because you know it was a part of her life, and I just knew that she had a prescription. So I figured you know it's the supportive thing was to say just do what your doctor says.
None of this is your fault. You don't create an addict.
And you also don't have to lay down any rules.
Yeah.
You're not the enforcer and you're not her parents. You get to be in this kind of divine place of being a really good guy who will, if you go to Al-Anon, understand what your boundaries are so that you can also go, maybe I can't take this right now. But you're not a punching bag. But you do get to be the person who doesn't bring the conflict, doesn't bring the, you know.
Well, and to that point, what happens when people actually start to get well is the loved ones start to unload on them. So expect her family to suddenly be angry and unloading and don't get engaged in a split, you know, siding with her against the family. Just realize everyone's going to have their feelings. And let them have them and take them all the family stuff to Al-Anon and the family groups.
Well, one last angle about this. You guys are setting up as a nice guy because I'm curious and I'm asking questions. If I'm really self-aware, part of what I liked about her is she's a few years younger than me. She's the life of the party. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always been, like, I was married for several years to somebody who didn't drink at all, and I would, you know, occasionally drink, and then to be with somebody who drank more, who was just very vivacious and lively and fun and party girl, punk rock.
I understand what you're attracted to.
It's also, you know, if you're more...
I understand. We're codependents.
Of course. But that's also, you know, you're borrowing the function of her personality being bigger and brighter and bolder and more confident than your own.
Yes.
Which is
totally accurate.
Which is totally understandable. Yeah. But and that is going to change.
It's going to change.
She's
going to be okay. It's going to take some time. Don't you get to grieve the loss of who you thought she was, and she's going to be somebody even better. Don't worry. Just be open to it. And if it's not a relationship that works or she doesn't want it to work, I mean, that happens sometimes in treatment. But if when both people are participating, usually things kind of work out if both people are into it. And if she's into it and you're into it, it will work out.
Yeah. And it's your time. It's your turn to become that, because you were, like Amir said, you were sort of jonesing off of her high of being that person. So maybe it's time for you. That's something that's attractive to you. Maybe it's time for you to
look at that.
Be that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Take a look at that. And that's good for Al-Anon. Good for, you know, work there. See how predictable people are in these relationships.
Yes.
But, yes, we all have our roles.
But it's good. It's nice that it's predictable.
Yes.
It's nice to know you're not alone or these are things that are common.
It's exactly right. They are common as can be, and people who are experiencing these things for the first time don't know that.
Right. And you'll go to an Al-Anon meeting and you'll hear other people's stories and be like, oh, okay, mine's not that bad.
Yeah, oh, no, it's always worse.
Right? There is that thing where you're like, oh, it...
So that's what this is.
Yes.
Don't look for differences. Look for similarities, too.
Right. Your fear of that person, your uncomfortableness around that person, your experience of me on certain days probably feels the same as it did to that person who's... person sounded more chaotic, but they were still afraid or unsure or like, why am I in this or how much do I tolerate? You know, those are the things. The same with alcoholics. You go there, somebody lost their keys once on wine and said, I'm never letting this happen again. You know, and somebody else drove through a bank window, but they're still the same.
And they went and walked to the liquor store next door.
Yeah. I mean, there's stories where you go, well, I don't even qualify, man. Yeah. But you do because you felt that kind of misery, that lack of control, that inability to be yourself. And, you know, so it's you have more in common with people than you think.
So let's go back to the cancer. What was the malignancy?
Non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma in my intestine.
Right.
And they had cut me open to pull out my appendix, and then...
Oh, they thought I was unhappy, and you ended up having a lymphoma. Mm.
Yes.
No, he was on tour in Australia, and he had been having stomach pains, and he had gone to the doctor here a couple of times, and they thought it was gastritis, and they gave him different medications.
It didn't show up in my blood work.
And then he went to Australia, what was supposed to be 3 months, and after 2 weeks, he called me and was... in the ER and said they found clusters of tumors in my stomach. They think I have cancer. I'm coming home.
Before they opened you up for thinking it was an appendix?
Yeah, they did an MRI.
MRI. Saw an MRI.
And then,
when they opened him up, they realized they couldn't take the cancer without cutting off the blood flow to his intestines, but also that his appendix looked weird. So they took that as well.
Was there lymphoma in there?
No. No, but they were afraid it would get there.
Yeah.
And so then they sent me home and said, let this wound heal and then we'll start the chemo. And then my intestine shut down. And they were like, we got to start the chemo at the same time. So the wound stayed open for 6 months.
Oh, that's good.
And that's where the OxyContin
came
in.
It would reopen.
Oh, Jesus.
And get a staph infection. It was so brutal.
Good times.
It was so brutal.
So what was the chemo they gave you? CHOP, one of those old things? Or what they gave
and
you?
And the Rituxan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was good. And my doctor was like, look,
it's curable illness. Great news.
That's what he said. Yeah. When you wake up.
If you're going to have cancer, this is a good one.
Do you know what kind of cell type you had? Was it like a large cell?
Large B cell.
Yeah.
Yep.
So those are curable.
Yeah. And it was, and the experience was over in 6 months. I mean, really. But the Oxy was a nightmare.
The treatment was over in 6 months.
Nightmare.
But yeah.
I've never been through anything as bad. I've never been through anything worse in my life.
Think about
take a bullet now.
I know. Think about the fact that is an epidemic in this country.
I can't, I don't know how, and I think people don't even understand, people mostly are not getting high. They're not wanting to go through withdrawal because the withdrawal is looking over a cliff that never ends. And the despair and then the weird, your body, it never is the same withdrawal every day. your insides ache, you think you have cancer again, you're sweating for no reason.
Thing, right. The pain is intensified while you're on the opiate and you're in this sort of chronic withdrawal and you're in and you have hyperalgesia, and it's just a freaking nightmare.
Yeah.
Yep. And your addiction's kicking in, so that's playing games in your head all the time.
Yep.
That's where the thinking and the diversion and the lying and the obfuscating and the bullshitting, all that kicks in.
All of it.
And it gets intensified because it's opiate addiction now.
Yes.
Yeah. It's sort of on steroids.
Yeah. How can you warn people off this stuff? But it really is a nightmare. But it also – it can be – I wouldn't recommend it if you can get to a rehab, but I did the Suboxone,
all the way off?
Yeah, but you had to land it like a slow landing plane. It took me about a year and a half.
Yeah. Good for you to get all the way off because very few, if they don't make it in the first few weeks, ever get off.
Yes.
That's the nature of
this
thing.
That's what everybody kept saying to me. I go, but I'm reducing it, and every time I try and jump.
Well, once you get down to about 2 1-milligram, you start getting withdrawal again. And then people go, oh, no, I'm not going to go through this.
Right.
And sometimes the Suboxone withdrawal is a little more unpleasant. It's just different. It's an unpleasant withdrawal.
Every day was a different thing.
Yeah,
like it was.
And then you're not yourself for like 6 months. Or
oh my
12.
God! And then, but you think you're trying to be, and you can't contextualize it. Yes. And you feel okay, and then people are looking at you like, are you? You know, like. Where is everybody? What happened to all my friends? Why is everyone afraid of me? The girls are jumping. You know, you're like,
I hope you had a good sober peers around and stuff that could, you know.
I do. And I have a good program and I have a great,
it's just so horrible and so miserable. And you have to have guys that can laugh with you about it and punch you in the head about it.
But the problem was I drifted from my program. And so if I had had people around me when I started taking the oxy at the beginning, if I'd have called my sponsor.
They might have kicked your ass. They might not have been able to control it because the doctors are telling you, take this stuff. You have an open wound. What are you supposed to do?
Yeah. That's right.
A lot of recovery people back off at that point.
I always say if somebody wants to talk about it, I'm willing to go talk about it with them and say, because I feel like they owe you a detox after – if they prescribe it for you, they should put you on a detox.
How about sitting you down and going, didn't mean to do this, but now we have a second problem here.
Sure.
We need to deal with this. You would have gone, oh, okay.
So you're a doctor. Why wouldn't you do – okay, so if the pain is in your stomach, because you can still feel the pain. That's the other thing. Your stomach still hurts. You just don't mind it. Yeah, on the oxy, whatever, you have this weird thing. Why couldn't you – I guess you couldn't do a local? Why wouldn't you localize the pain relief?
Yeah, you can't really – there's no such
– You can't
plot.
Do that.
Yeah, the neurology is too complex there.
It is.
The pain.
Okay.
Neurology.
That's because that seems like if you could solve that problem, you wouldn't have to make people string them out.
But it's amazing.
But there are lots of ideas about things that could be done otherwise. You know, because now finally everyone woke up to the opiate issue.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And it's not a good thing for chronic pain.
Well, thank God it hit old white men because now it's an epidemic. And it was destroying people before, but thank God old white men were falling out of buildings.
Now we'll do something about it.
Now we'll do something about it. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Crazy. What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say that, you know, the thing that's so frustrating is, you know, when he, you know, the doctor would be like, well, it shouldn't hurt anymore. It shouldn't hurt anymore. But they didn't go, oh, well, it's also you're in complete withdrawal.
Right. What you do is you know what? The opiates perpetuate pain and it can make it seem chronic. It puts you in chronic withdrawal.
Right.
It gives you hyperalgesia. Your addiction is now kicked in. We need to take you off this stuff. And you will not have pain when we get you off it, or the pain will be tolerable.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
I mean,
no one ever says that.
No. And also,
and that's actually the truth.
Right. I can't imagine it's hard to prescribe something you've never.
But they make you feel bad for not being able to handle what's going on when he literally.
They don't know.
Was
they literally don't know what they don't.
Such
understand.
A mess. Yeah. It was so awful.
Hard to prescribe what?
Though it's interesting to prescribe it for somebody having never felt like if you are a psychoanalyst, right? You have to go through psychotherapy, don't you? You have to.
Yeah, but you know, you can be an oncologist and not have had cancer.
That's
right. You do develop objective judgment about these things, but if you're going to treat an alcoholic with opiates, you should know what that implies.
Yeah.
You just at least understand what that implies. It doesn't take much for a doctor just to go, oh, this could be a problem. I don't deal with this. I don't know it very well. Maybe I can get somebody who understands this particular kind of human being.
And I think the reason people drink in the first place is, you know, it's not because you it's because you go, oh, my God, I don't feel anxious.
Right.
I actually feel like the person I could be if I could get out of my fear.
I don't feel X, whether it's pain, anxiety, sadness, misery, whatever it is about myself.
And you discover I'm funny and I can talk to people and I feel okay. I'm a better person. So it's like this is who I am behind that wall. When I envision myself being a person who can talk to girls or whatever, now I can, you know, but I need more every time and then it goes to the wrong place. But you do – it is an attempt to write yourself – for social interaction
did not work for people that use them, they would not take them.
Well, it feels like
they work.
That's true.
Until they don't. And then the addiction makes
and
sure you keep
really
going.
And they really don't work.
But it does feel like the hangover. Like most people's hangover, the first hangover they have is the worst thing they've ever experienced. They're like, this is the worst thing I've ever experienced. And a lot of people go, okay, I take it easy with that stuff. And some people go, no, I'm back. I'm back. I can fight that. I can beat that guy.
Yeah, you know.
Alcohol under no certain terms lets you know. No, I will kill you. I mean, we can do this dance as long as you want, but I will kill you, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the chemo went how long?
Six months.
6 months.
Yeah.
And sometimes they do bone marrow transplants. Think, was that ever even talked about? Or no. Okay.
No. Nope. I came in. This is how great it was. I flew in from Australia. I went straight to Cedars. They started on Easter. It was Easter Sunday. And by Labor Day,
great.
That was it. And that's so –
And the wound had healed by then too, or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. A little bit, yeah. Was it? How long did we have her?
We had a nurse. We had a nurse coming every day.
When you say her, you mean the nurse, or
the nurse.
Was there a name for your wound?
No, there was.
I did. I named my wound Helen, and she.
We had someone that had to come to the house every day and clean it out and pack it.
Yeah. Good times.
Voila.
Yes, good times.
Now drop a marriage in that. And make somebody like and
drop
and also,
a marriage in it, and then add the addiction onto the end. That's super.
Tom Arnold had a similar. I think he had MRSA actually in his abdominal wound.
Really,
and he had he had obstruction because of opiate use, and so his whole thing was the opiate story. And so he now, when he's talking to young kids that have an opiate problem, he shows them his wounds.
Yeah.
He's like, you want to be like this?
It's major.
Take your drugs.
Yeah. And you do have that thing too, I think, sometimes where you're like, you don't need to still. Like, I get that. Like, there have been times where I was like, look, you don't have to be married to this. You know, that's the other thing. I have said on certain occasions, look, I understand. My mom was an alcoholic. I understand that I am, you know, this sort of unpredictable force.
So let's
life.
Talk about that. When you're looking to buy a car, you might hear a lot of crazy prices and, not prices so much as crazy terms like MSRP, invoice, list price, dealer price. No. You want the real price, the true price, and now you've got true price from True Car. You can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you ever get to the dealership. And you know once you've seen that scattergram and locked in a good price, you know you've locked in a price for an actual vehicle on the True Car certified dealer's lot. True Car certified dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home. How do you know your true price is a great price? Well, first of all, it's True Car. Secondly, True Car shows you what other people's paid for the same price, so you know the market's bearing, you know what's fair. And your certified dealer knows this, so they set their true price competitively so they can win your business. So when you're ready to buy new or used, that's right, don't forget they have used cars as well as new. You can visit True Car and enjoy that more confident car buying experiences. Some features not available in all states. Blinds Galore. Everything Blinds Galore creates is 100% custom, right to your specifications, made just for you when you place your order. Do not bother with the stress of dragging yourself out to the big box prepackaged stores. This is more than a blinds aisle. These are blinds experts. Plus, they're family owned and run, so you know they care. These guys are great. I've met all of them. We've used them. We use them as Corolla used them. We use them. And they will make sure you're happy. At BlindsGalore.com, you do it all from home. You get a 100% custom product at a better price. And BlindsGalore.com was the first place to buy blinds online. And they've covered over 2 million windows and counting. They make it easy. If you need design, advice, or measuring help, their expert in-house custom care team will be there for you every step of the way. I mean it. They do not drop the ball. They make sure you're happy. It's the same quality and care you'd expect from a professional designer, but without the big price tag. Blinds Galore will even set you up with 15 free samples, free shipping on top of the free expertise. So whatever your needs for blinds, Blinds Galore has exactly what you're looking for. Blinds Galore makes it easy to get the custom blinds and shades you've always wanted in your home. Go check out BlindsGalore.com and let them know I sent you. That is BlindsGalore.com. So when you were saying that, was it when you were on opiates?
Yeah, and afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. After. Yeah. So on the Suboxone or all the way off?
On the Suboxone.
Yeah.
And then finally when I was off too.
You would still say you don't have to be in this?
Yeah, it's been too much.
And is this a guilt you're expressing?
No, it's me looking at the quality of life and saying, yes, you can't get comfortable around me. I can't get comfortable around your discomfort. And so if you are not going to pull the trigger, I will, because I know what's happening. And
but you'd already been separated, right?
We'd been separated, and then we got back together, and then shortly thereafter, he got cancer.
And you've stayed together since the cancer,
mm-hmm.
even though Greg was trying to convince you to leave.
Yeah.
What made you stay?
Because I married him, and I, you know, and I really believe that the person I married was still in there, even through all the drug stuff and the behavioral changes and the delusion and the daily edginess and that kind of stuff.
Let me drill into that a little bit.
Okay.
Of course he's still there.
Right.
Why would you not trust that?
Because he hadn't been around in a while.
Because he'd been using.
Because part of why we separated was he was using. And then he.
So you relapsed before the.
I started to. I've been diagnosed as bipolar.
Yeah.
So after the. But I didn't know that. And after I had trod the boards with you, I thought, well, I am also a person who people come to for advice. So certainly I don't need help. So when I started to have these incredible mood swings, the manic to super depressive. One Christmas, I just took one of the dog's pills. It was a hydrocodone. I had no idea what it was, but my sister's eyes had gotten real big one day when she walked by it because she was an addict for most of her life.
So you got tired of the addict bullshit.
Yeah.
Really? She was just tired of that. And then you were tired of putting her through it because you didn't feel guilty.
I do.
Yeah, you feel guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
That's guilt. I feel guilty.
I understand it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, when, you know, I have, you know, what is it now, 19 months
sobriety.
Of sobriety. Good for you. Yeah, coming off the Suboxone and all
well
that,
done.
Right? So the I have an understanding of what that's like. I go every day. I listen to those stories and I listen to people be in things where they just are unhappy. And I just was like,
you don't want to do that to her.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's not my job to decide that, which I've been told, but I can feel like, and I'm not thriving because I'm so concerned about how she is. I'm not tending the farm.
I still feel like the Al-Anon piece would help.
Well, that,
you,
yeah, that's
help,
the thing
help
is
him
I,
with his
I'm,
guilt,
I'm,
help su- you?
I'm such a codependent.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
I didn't leave or whatever because I was so worried about him because he was he was not rational. He was so not him for so long, and I was just very concerned about him. And you know, he's the father of my children, and he's my favorite person. And it was that thing
you know
where
what it
I
is?
Was like,
you're having trouble separating the addict from Greg.
Yes,
and 100%. I see it very clearly. I see it super duper clearly.
Sure.
Now I didn't have to live in it for a long period of time, but again, Alan, I would really help you with that. Because I you know, I guess I have lots of experience dealing with this stuff, but to me they're very distinct things. Greg drug addict, Greg.
Right.
They're not the same, and I know you know that, but I don't know if you feel it quite right.
Well, I you know, there was no 2 days that were the same.
Dealing with a drug addict, really? Is that
so
how it works?
There was no consistency or continuity.
Again, dealing with a drug addict.
I know.
That's so
and when
I
you,
know.
And when you,
Greg, what the?
But you have to understand, it's like
and
when
bipolar,
I,
it's never I know. The same.
I know.
And when you've sort of felt like you go, look, I know the difference between before I started going to AA and after.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. So you do feel like, well, I am riding the ship. I mean, I'm going every day. I have commitments, and I'm, you know, like I'm doing everything. I'm meditating.
Yeah.
I'm doing this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm riding my bike. Like I'm taking.
Are you going to NA too or just AA?
Just AA. Although I do go to there's a couple of meetings that are specifically for just
pill.
Oxy.
For pill, yeah.
For
pill
pills.
Yeah, there's pill meetings. That's
yes.
good.
Yes. And and I can drop in on any meeting and hear something. Am I at a food meeting? That's fine. I'll stay.
Yeah.
I can
good.
Hear. I can
no,
what
that's
is
good.
It?
That's,
what are you addicted to? Shoes?
Let's
do it.
It. That's a good headspace for you to be in right now.
Yes,
for sure.
I can connect to a lot of the isms. So,
are you still traveling and working and stuff a lot?
No, I've managed to shut all that down. Okay. I managed to make it. I made myself fairly unemployable. So,
well,
so
you'll
I'm
get
rebuilding.
Back
yes,
you'll get back out there.
Yes.
So in the meantime, it's the books and the
podcast. In the meantime, we decided to try to save
and
our marriage.
That.
Do a podcast and dissect all of the heavy duty.
You guys ought to talk to other addict couples and stuff like that too, because you really would be an interesting conversation. Because we're all, you know, it'd just be an interesting. Because so much about addiction is sort of fittedness, and when you're intimately involved with somebody with addiction, and that fittedness is always different. And you would see it, you know, if you talked to another couple, you'd see stuff in the co and he'd see stuff in the attic.
Oh,
It'd be very interesting.
I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And also when you know, somebody goes, well, my dad is not, you know, he doesn't drink, and but he rages, right? But he rages. And so it's all still coming from, he's coming from a place of fear, and we're all living under his fear. Mm-hmm. You know, the president doesn't drink, you know, but he has a fear thing that makes people afraid of him, because otherwise he'd be able to be talked to at some point or whatever. And so I feel like we see that behavior and so it's applicable, you know, just in relationships.
Oh my God, yes. That's a great thing about addiction, because it's the human experience just sort of cracked open,
right?
And it's just everything, and everything's, you know, life and death too with that addiction. You have to take care of these things, like, you know, if it's not an addict there, a lot of relationships would have trundled along, never dealt with these things. Step one is an addict, you got to deal with everything.
Yeah,
you got to deal with it, because it's endangers the person with the illness. And
it's happening.
Yes, it's happening right now.
We refuse to apply logic and rules to love, because it's love, so it should be perfect. And it's like, no, man, it should be there. You know, we should have a meeting every day about the relationship, because we're both in it. And we had no lines of communication. And what happened was, this summer when the book looked like – and we were sort of stuck on the book. And I said, we should do a podcast. And she said, we should do a podcast after we write the book. And I was like – we should do a podcast before we write the book, because I don't even not sure what we're writing. And as soon as we added this extra person who wasn't there in our home just to do it, all of a sudden there was just this small amount of listening. We just talked.
Mm. Yeah.
It was just the conversations we were meant to have. I mean, we hadn't set out.
It's so hard in a marriage when you have all of these like historical traumas and injuries to actually be on good behavior and not be triggered by your person in any sort of conflict or confrontation, where you like dig back up all these feelings. They come rushing into your body.
Yes, and you may have to take them somewhere else.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, you have to decide to commit to things, which sounds like you guys have.
We've certainly have tried.
Yeah, we're getting there.
We
we said the other day, you know, your future can't – I mean, your past can't fight your future. You know, all this past stuff, they cannot
– No, you got to find forgiveness and gratitude and humility and all that good stuff.
Yes, yes. And I think – so then setting up a marriage, I think it's – you know, you kind of want to go, I want to make this – I love this person. So for them, to me, this has to be the safest space. They should feel as free – I think I think there's a difference between freedom and crossing a line. I think there is a difference between.
Okay, so you're granting her that freedom in a way, whether she takes it or not. Yeah.
Yes, or if somebody's starting out in a marriage, you're like, you should let your person be able to come to you and go, I think I want to have sex with other people. I feel like I want to drink again. I don't want to be ashamed in front of you. I hate my I hate my body or whatever. Like, I feel like sometimes we or maybe the person's open to it and we don't think they are. But I do feel like
– it's hard for co's to say stuff like that.
It is.
Very hard.
No.
Because we're very contained and control things and fixing things and perfecting things.
Right. And they come to you like that.
But we start like that.
Yeah. That's right.
But to still – sort of to reinforce that freedom and that acceptance,
right,
I think is very cool and very important.
Yes. And yeah. I also think, you know, in the story where she said, I want to tell her these stories, and she said, I don't want to hear them. I also don't think I found a way to broach the topic. It wasn't that I wanted to talk about those stories. I wanted to have an open discussion about our own sex life. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to reference my past. Mm-hmm. I could have been more general about what happens with an alcoholic and what my experiences are, rather than telling war stories.
Right. Like the way you tell in a man's, you do it, you know, without hurting people. And the same thing would be true about history. It's like maybe more mystery, less history in certain areas.
Right. Right. So. Right. But I think sometimes you are trying to warn somebody. Like, I'm not perfect.
I understand. And that's the part that, you know, you don't want the codependent to insist on you to be perfect, because you're not. And we kind of go that way automatically, because that's what we demand of ourselves.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we don't really want it from you, but you feel it though still anyway.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah, codependency is actually a little more delicate process, believe it or not, than addiction.
Yes.
And it's a little earlier injuries and stuff.
Well, I also, you know, I think one of the things we did learn in therapy was people like me feel like we have all the feelings. We're the sensitive ones. It's like, no, the person who doesn't talk about anything is so hurt they can't talk.
Yeah.
Right?
I still think the addict is the more sensitive constitutionally.
Yes.
We just have more difficulty accessing our feelings.
Yeah.
Because, and they're very tender.
I always say that I'm partially made of wood.
Yeah, you're not.
You're
not. You feel like you are.
Immediately spills emotion.
Yeah,
just like shutting down.
Right, but then that, again, just like Sam, who we talked to, that's the kind of stuff you're attracted to and you like because it's
right.
You know, you wish you were that way, or you have part of you as it could be.
Yes, no, they're my people.
That's why you like artists.
Yeah, and it's okay to like addicts, alcoholics. It's a fittedness.
It's just for sure.
You have to do your own work to
of course
to not hurt them and not hurt yourself and all kind of thing. Do you guys see individual therapies too, or just all couples therapy?
We did individual therapy and then we did couples therapy and all of it I found fascinating. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed all of it. I highly recommend if people
are
having.
Was it painful ever?
We didn't do a lot of what was asked. If I'm being honest, we have to be honest.
That's the way couples therapy tends to go.
Well, if you still aren't okay with your person, why would you? If the therapist says, I want you to go home and sit back to back and read together or whatever the thing is, and they're like, yeah, no, I don't. I can barely get them in the car here.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm in. You know,
right.
I'm like,
ew, I don't want to touch you yet.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm still hurt.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good that you can joke about it.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. No, but it is that thing. But I found it really, really fascinating and very enjoyable. And I also feel like, in writing this book about marriage and all of the ways that we have blown it and set ourselves up to fail and have failed, it is that thing where we've gone through and really actually recognized what we still really like about each other and why we have been able to withstand some incredible trials and traumas when people around us have fallen. Because a lot of the people that a lot of our friends that did get divorced, they all say, if I could do it over again, I would still pick the same person. I would just do it differently.
And often they say, I wouldn't have gotten divorced either. It wasn't worth it.
It wasn't worth
it. And guess what? You can find your way back to that person just the way you're doing it right now, what you're talking about, which is that it's still Greg.
Yes.
The drug addiction has interfered.
Sure.
But it's still Greg. And
it's interesting, it does feel like days you go, like, there's no love there. There's just no love. I don't feel it. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel like that. But then you go, like, every once in a while, like, a childhood sweetheart will come up and you'll be right there. You go, right? Just for a moment, you're like, oh my God, I remember what that felt like. And so it's there. It's just that it's so covered up.
Right.
I mean, I think the real loves of our lives are always there, but we, sometimes we do it for coping mechanisms. Sometimes we just do it because we've gotten the way that we.
And also, in a marriage, I mean, we get into this place where, you see everybody's everything on their social media. And so you think everyone's having their best life.
Yeah.
And then your every day isn't a highlight reel.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're unsatisfied with something that actually is just meant to be like smooth and steady with some great highs and occasional lows. But, it sort of skews what the barometer is for a good marriage or a good life or a good relationship,
Yes. It's not all Yahoo.
Also, those people are they're projecting what they hope it looks like.
Yeah.
That's not the truth either. That is a moment that they go, I want this to be true about me. And so this is what I want to tell people. But, when you know people, you go, well, I mean, I'm sure it was like that hour. And then the next hour, it was horrible.
Yeah.
And then it was okay. Yeah, and then you went to bed.
They're not posting that hour.
You need more nourishing experiences than pleasurable experiences necessarily.
Yeah.
Nourishing and filling.
What we're just saying is post your fights.
Yeah. Euphoria is good once in a while, but the eudaimonia is really where we're trying to center things. All right, so get the book. They made the mistakes. Read about them so you don't make them and realize how to adjust course. It's How to Keep Your Marriage from Sucking. It's available now on Amazon.
It is indeed.
Yes.
Keys to Keep Your Wedlock Out of Deadlock. Maybe it's you. I look forward to hearing some interviews. I would love to hear you doing couples interviews with each, couple.
I mean,
stuff.
If you'd like to come on.
Send some our way.
You. All right, fair enough. We will do it. And that about does it. We'll follow you on Twitter. We'll look for GregoryBarrett.com. And did I miss anything else? No.
Nope.
And,
that's it.
Great, guys. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks
really
for
fun.
Having us, Drew.
Good to see you again.
You too.
We'll see you all next time.
for call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.